Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
Ashita no koto wo io to tenju no nezumi ga waru. And welcome to Shift F1, a podcast about speedy race cars and pitch-perfect Japanese pronunciation. That is, by the way, Japanese for when I talk about tomorrow, the mice in the ceiling laugh. Which is roughly equivalent to the English expression, men make plans and God laughs. Meaning, Rob, that we can never really know what will happen tomorrow. Max Verstappen might not win. It could happen.
It's happened at least once before.
It has. I'm Drew Scanlon. Joining me, that is Rob Zachney. How are you, Rob?
Not too bad. Looking forward to an early Japanese Grand Prix. Curious to see what the new like slot in the schedule does for it, like what the weather is like. But seems happy to be going to another like classic F1 track this early in the season.
Yeah, I was preparing the track walk and just getting excited for Suzuka again. You will note, if you are a regular listener, that Nanny O'Dwyer is once again out this week. He shall be back next week. I'm just going to read this note that he gave to in our Discord here to tell the audience that he had a sudden stomach-related illness a few weeks ago, had surgery last week to remove his gallbladder, and is now recovering. So he also wants you, the audience, to know that I miss them and was super pissed I didn't get to chat about the last race because, but he has been listening into the podcast over the past few weeks. So thank you, Danny. Get well soon. Seems to be doing all right. But yeah, if you are new to this podcast, there's usually three of us, but you know, Danny will be back. We'll be back up to the full triumvirate next week. And if you are new to Formula One itself, we have got an episode just for you. Our preseason primer episode assumes no prior F1 knowledge and explains how the sport works and who everybody is. So if you'd like to go back and listen to that and get up to speed, it's episode 257. Also, this show would not be possible without our audience over at patreon.com/shiftf1, where every month we release an ad-free version of the podcast, along with bonus podcasts and videos exclusively for our patrons that cover racing documentaries and films, F1 video games, experiments with other racing series, and a lot of weird things. So if you'd like to support the show and get access to all that fun stuff, head over to patreon.com/shiftf1 or click the link in the show notes. This month, we will be posting the second half of our Drive to Survive review. So get ready for that. First half is already up, and you can hear.
Did we pick the next thing yet? It occurs to me now, if that's about to go up, I don't know what we're doing next.
Yeah. In the following month, in the month of May, I guess we'll have to go to the list.
We're avoiding Herbie the Love Bug.
Well, you could send us a note on Patreon, perhaps. Like, these fine folks have the title sponsors for this week's show. We have a new one, Rob. Please welcome to the podium, Mansell's Mustache.
Beautiful.
Yes. Also beautiful, we've got Get Rich or Die Ryan, Agave ATX, Cyphus Training, Turf SCS, at Team Blackjack, Michael Maves, Gordy's Army, at Talking Autos, TelemetryDeck.com, FTC, Drew Stewart, Bailey Foot, Abdullah Althani, Jason Chadwick, Abraham Getchell, The Space Above Us Podcast, Bunny Crimes with all the vowels removed, Bunny Crimes, Snigs, Alex Goucher, Max Voltar, Circuit Demon, Troy Stammer, William Rumpf, Irvine Clinical Research, Lachlan the Madden Man, and Jason Kelly. Rob, it strikes me now that I have to read these. There's a few in there that I feel like would be good vocal warm-ups. I don't know if you and your illustrious podcasting career have ever done that or sought to do vocal warm-ups beforehand.
I probably should. I haven't done vocal warm-ups since I was on Speech and Debate. Actually, it's not Speech and Debate. It's two separate teams in high school, but I was on both of them because I was awesome and I was just like super popular. But yeah. That's the last time I did vocal warm-ups, and I always felt so silly because it had such like it was like there was theater kid and like speech kid overlap, as you might imagine, and so it was just too much theater kid energy, I think, and I turned against the whole concept of the vocal warm-up.
Abdullah Althani, Abraham Getchell. The Human Torch was denied a bank loan. All right. Well, now that we're all warmed up, let's jump right into the news, Rob. You have assembled a rogues gallery here of...
Oh, it's all fun. I think the big one, I was really hoping Danny would be here for this one because this is a world that he knows much, much better than I do. But like the big news in not F1 world, but like F1 corporate world, is that Liberty Media has like done a deal to acquire MotoGP. They bought out the people currently who own the series, along with some other lower formulae of motorcycle racing. $4 billion.
Oh boy,
is what that costs.
Four Instagrams.
There are some interesting. There are some interesting details here. For one, apparently, there's been a long time interest in ownership of F1 rights at that level to acquire MotoGP.
Oh, really? So Liberty Media, the owners since, oh boy, when did they buy F1?
20. So, remember, I feel like Bernie Ecclestone did a like partnered with like CVC Capital Partners. But yeah, there was somebody predating Liberty.
But yeah, so Liberty current owners of Formula One are now buying the Formula One of motorcycles.
Yeah. And CVC Capital Partners was a partial owner of MotoGP, but I can't remember the name of the investment group that Liberty bought out when sort of Ecclestone was shown the door as well. But anyway, apparently in 2006, CVC was looking at doing something similar where they wanted to acquire both F1 and MotoGP, but they were concerned, or at least they were warned off by European antitrust, according to Autosport here, that any sort of acquisition of both of the sort of premier motorized racing series in the world would be frowned upon from an antitrust standpoint. And so they kind of abandoned the idea. Something about the regulatory environment maybe has shifted that Liberty feels they can do this now, but it still has to be seen, still has to be signed off on by European regulators. I'm curious how this goes. It's like they're kind of hard to figure out what they're gonna pull the trigger on, what they're gonna let
the
slide.
Regulators.
But pretty much, yeah. They're gonna. From my perspective, I think it'd be a pretty easy case to make that you can't have the same ownership of like the two premier motor racing series in the world. Like, it just can't be, you can't have it. But, you know, regulators allow a lot of mergers and acquisitions that sort of look kind of weird on their face. But we'll see how this one goes. I just have a hard time seeing it not as, from the regulatory standpoint, it just seems like it'd be an easy case to make, because even though I don't think we necessarily think of them this way, if you're looking at people who want to see, like, you know, best like motorsports athletes and the most advanced machinery, MotoGP and Formula One are kind of it, right? Like, everything else in terms of, I guess, maybe you could argue, like, World Endurance Championship, maybe. Mm-hmm. But that's, they run fewer events. They've done a lot to sort of keep costs down and make it more, a little more spec, I think, a little more accessible.
It's also tougher. Yeah, it's not as accessible. It's pretty, to a viewer, it can be tough to watch. Endurance racing, that is. Whereas, like, yeah, you know, MotoGP it's even easier than Formula One from, like, a time investment. Those races are, like, 45 minutes. No pitting, nothing. Just, you know, sit down and go. White knuckle it till the end.
Yeah, so, like, they're kind of, they're very similar products in a lot of ways. Just, you know, I think a lot of us as viewers tend to be either four-wheel or two-wheel type people in terms of what we get into. I think, you know, Danny's the outlier on this podcast, like, you know, follows both pretty intensely. But it just seems like these are probably two racing series you would want to remain in some sort of competition. Both of them being under one roof is kind of, it's kind of a big deal. I'm curious how that aspect of it goes.
Yeah, so I had a MotoGP phase as well. Something that I would love to get back to if I had more viewing time available. And I think this strikes me as just at first blush, like they're hedging their bets for when Formula One isn't a good product, which one might argue right now it's not. I mean, it remains to be seen the rest of the season, but like it's not fun when one driver wins the whole time. Thankfully, you know, we have, you know, and trying to impart our listeners with the depth of knowledge where we can find interesting things in a race that are, you know, away from the top position. But, you know, MotoGP, I imagine, has its ups and downs too. So by diversifying, they're always going to be providing a good motorsport product. And I imagine there's a lot of, like, you know, I'm sure there's a business catchphrase for this, but, like, you know, because you've learned a lot, Liberty Media has learned a lot about this motorsport, they can apply it, you know, to this other one, right? Well, you know, here comes the Drive to Survive of MotoGP. I think they've tried to do one, or they are doing one, or something like that. There's in our Patreon idea list, there's definitely something like that. I mean, but in terms of, like, the type of person, I think there's a lot. Well, I am the type of person. We are the type of people where, if, at least for me, the reason I wanted to watch it was because, like, there were only so many Formula One races, and this is another motorsport that is different in an interesting way, but still has that excitement of, like, the international, you know, Olympic style, you know, moving circus. It's very well attended at races. It's a sort of a European centric curiosity to me as an American, which is fun. And it's watched by a lot of people. And so it's that sort of, like, esoteric, but also, highly energized and, a lot of money in it that, like, that blend is really attractive to me. So that's why I started watching it, and, you know, certainly watching things like Hitting the Apex really fueled that. So if they can harness all of that, like, they would have a lock on the world's premier, you know, motor racing thing. And that is, like you said, that might turn into a bad thing for viewers, because I always thought that MotoGP for a long time had a lock on the broadcast, techniques. They had beaten Formula One in terms of what it was like to actually watch their product, like the sectors and qualifying. We take that for granted now. MotoGP had that years before Formula One did, right? When you're watching qualifying and you're seeing the sectors light up as, you know, oh, this guy's improving, hyper slow motion, all kinds of, the augmented reality stuff, like the arrow pointing over, here's who this driver is at the same time, and they're going this fast. MotoGP had that way ahead. So if you take that away, that competition, there's no reason then for one of them to try to outstrip the other.
Yeah. And I think that'd be certainly part of it. I also think, you know, a few months ago, we didn't read this email, but somebody wrote in talking about, like, were we bagging on Liberty Media too much and just how they run the sport. And their argument was, look, the sport's more popular than ever. It's more lucrative than ever. Like, they've been great for the sport. Why do we give them so much shit? And I think my position on Liberty has always been, I think any dumbass could have made F1 blow up the way it has. I really don't give them much credit for it at all. Because ultimately, the reason F1, like one of the major reasons F1 didn't grow more in popularity was that Bernie Ecclestone had some really outmoded views on media and did a lot to, I think, make the sport less appealing and less present on any sort of new media, right? This was a sport that under Ecclestone basically had no YouTube presence, didn't want highlights to be a thing that went out there. It was a really poorly run media company because you had a weird old man who would not do a deal unless somebody gave him, like, a here's what's in it for you personally type pitch on it. And I think that ultimately, like, once you took off, you know, those evil elfin little ankle weights that F1 was struggling with under Ecclestone, I think you sort of saw it ascend to its natural level. The other thing is they got very lucky with Drive to Survive, it blowing up. But I think the people pitching Drive to Survive and making that probably executed the idea a bit more than the person who signed off on it on the F1 side. I cover a media company where we had a CEO come in on the back of, you know, look at the great things they did at A&E. They're the person who made Ice Road Truckers. And it was like, no, they're the person who, like, accepted the pitch for Ice Road Truckers. But, like, they didn't do anything. They just, like, said yes to a good idea, and then it blew up, and they take credit for it. I feel that warmly toward how Liberty has operated the sport in its tenure. I think this calendar is too freaking long. Their approach has been, we just want to saturate now all the demand there can possibly be for the sport. And that is where I see, like, maybe if I don't know what the MotoGP calendar is, but, you know, get ready if there's any sort of unmet need or any perceived possibility of unmet need for MotoGP, Liberty's MO is to, you know, stick a race there. Go on.
Just on that note, actually, one of the things that's been turning me off of MotoGP lately, and maybe this is unfounded, people let me know, I've casually looked into it, like, oh, what's, maybe I poke in my head and see what's going on in MotoGP, and I saw that they are now doing sprint races too. And the thing I loved about MotoGP was that I could just tune in for 45 minutes and then I'm out, right? And I don't know that I'm as interested when I've got to also watch the sprint races too. And that's that, I think, you put the, you know, large calendar and sprint races, that to me is the Liberty's other big thing.
Yeah. Ultimately, that's, I'm with you there. It's like there are a lot of things they are doing that are explicitly about, I don't know. Basically, it's just, can we keep the store open longer? Is how it feels, and not necessarily like make it a richer experience.
We just bought the NFL. There's now 32 games per season. Check it out.
Well, that's actually a really good example. The only reason that hasn't happened is because there's a union, right? Like, that's the only reason it has not happened is because there's a union, and there are no unions in motorsports. And I do think, like, the Liberty approach is kind of, in the long term, how you get unions. Like, you know, as you put more wear and tear on people.
There is the GDPA. I wonder if they, like, how that works, if they have any leverage. I often don't hear them come out and say,
it's just, know, not how it operates. Yeah. I think it, like, this has been discussed, like, the GDPA is like a, equivalent to a driver's union, because at various places, like, they have occasionally, like, worked together to force changes and shut down races. But, like, ultimately,
mostly I think around safety.
Right. And ultimately, that scene in Rush where Niki Lauda wants to call off the race, and he puts it to the vote of the Drivers Association, and nobody votes for it. Like, ultimately, they're like, come on, we all know it's dangerous, but we're going to race. I think that's kind of still the case, is too many drivers are, you know, their position is, we're here to race, we want to race, outside of extraordinary circumstances, like the type of stuff that got Group B rally canceled. You don't see drivers pull the plug on things like this. And the other part is, you know, sports union leaders talk about this where, you know, there's the class system, right? The interests of the people at the very top who are established superstars and the people who are, like, coming in on, like, rookie contracts, they're diametrically opposed, right? There's very little shared interest in how those two sides regard the risk of a strike, anything like that. So I don't know. I am curious if you would see any of that change. My suspicion is if you were to see, like, labor action F1, it would be around factory staff and mechanics. And if MotoGP goes that way, you know, we'll see what happens there. The other thing that the article mentions is just, you know, again, Liberty's had great success in promoting F1 in America. That's a market MotoGP would love to break into. I feel like, I'm curious. Like, I think MotoGP is one of those things where if you describe it to someone, you show them, like, if you show them a race and also tell them how fast those bikes are actually going, despite how it may appear, MotoGP, like, is inherently awesome. And you're like, holy shit, this is really impressive stuff. But I will say, America doesn't have the best car culture, but there still is a car culture.
Mm-hmm.
American motorcycle culture kind of sucks, right? Like, well,
those bikes do not look like Harleys,
right? And that, and like, and that is what defines American motorcycling for a lot of people, is a very increasingly old, demographic of people riding massive Harleys modded to be as obnoxious as possible, and very crude sounding, crude looking machines. So I would be curious how easily MotoGP and what makes those bikes special would penetrate American consciousness, given that, like, this is a country where you would still have people looking at, like, high-end Japanese bikes and being like, oh, that's a little rice rocket, stuff like that. So it's, I like, American motorcycling, I think, is a little xenophobic, and also, like, very complacent in what it likes. And maybe that doesn't matter. Like, you have a motorsports culture independent of what people engage with, but...
Yeah, I'm not sure, you know, being a motorcycle fan helps, but, like, I know nothing about motorcycles, right? And I still really enjoyed watching MotoGP when I was watching it. I think...
You never had a phase where you're like, I could get into riding a bike.
I mean... There's that like romantic notion.
In my 20s, it was a someday thing for me. When I had the money, I was going to buy a nice bike.
I do look hard at, like, whenever I pass them on the street, like a Royal Enfield or a Triumph. Alexis Gajisa, former designer at CBS Interactive, Giant Bomb, GameSpot, had a Triumph and taught me how to ride it in the parking lot of the Presidio. And yeah, it's real fun. It's real cool. It's very scary because those things are heavy, man. Like, I did not realize just how heavy they were. And, like, as much fun as I had riding it around a parking lot, I thought, I can never ride this on a street. It's too dangerous. I'm too scared to do it.
It scares the shit out of me.
Yes.
Like, that was the hurdle, is like I'm talking to a friend who did motorcycle a fair bit. It's like, well, you're gonna have a spill. You're gonna go down and you need to, like, prepare for your first accident on a motorcycle. And I'm like, well, I would simply prefer not to have that accident, my friend. I would prefer not to have to learn to dump on the low side of the bike right. when I see that it's about to go over. But I'm with you. Like, dude, there's someone in my apartment complex, I don't know who, has like a vintage Triumph, and it is just a hauntingly gorgeous machine every time I go past it. And every time I go past it, I'm like, man, I'd love to die like Lawrence of Arabia. just eat shit on your beautiful bike.
I think my point of kind of pointing that stuff out is that when you learn more about Formula One, or you even look at a Formula One car, you can kind of grasp, like, okay, those wings, I think I kind of know what they're doing, and it's got four wheels, and it's probably got, you know, it's got the suspension. I can see it right there.
Yeah.
It's not as immediately understandable the technology that's going into what's making these bikes so fast. Like, it's electronics. It's, yeah, there's aerodynamics, but they're harder to see. You're managing, you know, a front and a back tire differently than like all four tires of the same compound. It's just one more level of strange to a newcomer, especially, you know, I'd say an American, where it's not like, you know, in Italy and Spain, I think it's motorcycle culture, or at least motorcycle racing culture, is much more diffused into the culture. In America, you got chrome and you got handlebars. Like, that's kind of all people know about motorcycles generally. That's what's exciting or interesting to me about it, that it is less transferable from the things that I know. But I think if you're talking about trying to make it mass market in the way that Formula One is to an American audience, that's a much steeper hill to climb.
I would bet you, though, if they start adding a bunch of like American MotoGP events for a few years there, at least, I'll bet you that'd be a real bang for your buck ticket you could get.
I mean, they go to Circuit of the Americas.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're right.
I haven't seen them run it. I should take a look, because you hear about the bumps on that track, so I'm curious how the bikes deal with it. But the last point I'll make on this, by the way, I am curious how this deal was financed. Hmm. How much did they have to finance versus how much were they able to get done with cash on hand? Because if you are FOM and Liberty just bought MotoGP, you have to be thinking you're absolutely getting screwed on the Concorde Agreement, right? You have, like, there's so much excess profit in the deal we've got that you could acquire MotoGP.
Why not give us some more of that TV credit?
Come on. Like,
yeah.
We're running seasons on $150 million a year, and there is and there's this much money. And
there's four bills
being
just
siphoned
around
out of the sport that you just buy. You just buy the F1 of motorcycle racing? Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Like, that is the like, when your boss sort of loudly and ostentatiously talks about like the new addition they're putting on their home, or the new place they just bought, or the vacation home. It's like, interesting information, my friend. That's that's great. But I do think it's kind of worse here, because ultimately this is, you know, the commercial rights holder that has this. So I'm very curious how much this was a deal to sort of put together financing versus what they had on hand. Either way, there's a lot of dimensions to this. Like, this feel to me, it feels like like this would be earth-shattering news if I knew MotoGP a little bit more. Mm. I'm curious, like, if we had Danny here, what the vibe would be for some other, like, you know, more faithful MotoGP fans, and whether that's a marriage that they actually want or excited about, or whether there's trepidation about the two things being merged.
I'd be curious to hear from our audience. I'm sure there are people who watch MotoGP there. So yeah, hit us up on Discord or shiftf1podcast@gmail.com. And before, if you don't have anything else on this, Rob?
Yeah.
Or do you?
No, I was going to move on to the next story.
Okay. I was going to step away for an ad break, but we will be back with the news shortly. All right, Rob. What else do we have from the news?
Well, if we're talking about big checks, then you know you're talking about Lawrence Stroll. And apparently, just in, you know, file it under another, you know, sharks are circling type story. Again, Autosport just has a story that Adrian Newey was made a very lucrative offer from Aston Martin to come join Aston Martin, leave Red Bull, and come work there. And there's a few dimensions of it. Like, obviously, it makes the Aston Martin F1 effort immediately much more serious and credible. And this is definitely the phase where you want him with new regulations coming in. Like, if you can get that guy, you know, sketching on a piece of paper by 2025, you know, you'd certainly want to do it. And the other part is, I'm curious about this. Like, some of the gloss that the Autosport piece put on it was that it could be a way to signal and reassure Fernando Alonso that the team is going places and, you know, they would be able to retain him longer. I am curious what his age is undeniable. You know,
Alonso's?
Yeah. Actually, it's a good point. Newey too is in his mid 60s, I want to say.
I think so.
You know, obviously it's a different gig, but yeah. With Alonso, I'm curious to what degree is Aston Martin building around Alonso versus using Alonso as a bridge to, you know, wherever it is they want to go.
Yeah, this is a weird one. My inclination is to think it's not going to happen just because Newey is just so entrenched with Horner and Red Bull. You know, he's been with them kind of since the beginning, I think.
Yeah, he was the first, like, he was sort of the keystone of the entire effort. Like, he was, when the whole thing came together with Dietrich Mateschitz and, you know, Christian Horner, I think Adrian Newey was, like, part of the initial, like, and this is who has to be overseeing it technically.
Well, and that still has to be the case, right? He clearly is on top of his game. He's on top of the field. Red Bull has got to match whatever Stroll gives him, right?
I think,
you're done. Like, you can't, I don't know how you can expect to stay on top without that guy.
No, they would certainly want and try to match whatever is offered. Lawrence Stroll may have the kind of money where that doesn't matter. I'm not sure what the rules are regarding how much money can be injected into a team that isn't part of the team's operating revenue or capital. Obviously, you know, there are rules like that in soccer where if you have a rich owner, they cannot just reach into their pocket too much and then just finance a ton of flashy acquisitions. But I think it certainly feels like this might also be to do with the fact that everyone is looking at Red Bull and just sees that that house is on fire and people might be looking to leave just because of, one has to imagine the vibes suck right now. Even if you're Adrian Newey trying to stay aloof from it all, I can't imagine it is awesome to have there be this much uncertainty with your star driver. Your boss and, like, chief professional collaborator for, you know, decades at this point is involved in harassment allegations that have not been dispelled nor gracefully handled. And there appears to be some sort of power struggle happening near the top of the team, which casts doubt on, like, when the dust clears, who you're going to be working with and for.
Yeah. I got to believe, though, that Newey could at any moment go anywhere for any amount of money. I think the only thing that makes Aston, if I could just project, you know, psychology onto him, interesting is that it would be a turnaround story.
Yeah.
Right. He would be able to basically say, look what I did single-handedly, if he was able to bring that team to the top.
Yeah, that's the thing for me. Like, I don't know anybody who plays like a game like Football Manager and they want to start by playing like Manchester City or something. You know, like, it's just not, that's not the fun of that. The fantasy is you take something that's small and like second or third rate and you guide it to the top. And I gotta believe there's a bit of fun for that too, if you're someone who's like really good at standing up and leading organizations and technical teams. You know, you've done everything you could at Red Bull. Maybe, you know, you can dominate the next era as well, but to a degree you're defending the title all the time. And it could be satisfying a different level to go and execute a turnaround or a leveling up. But I'm with you. That's the only real...
Because Red Bull's given him everything else.
The possibility that Red Bull's a mess. Yeah.
They presumably have given him mountains of money. And he also is able to... Like, he talks about in his book, How to Build a Car, which I read a few months ago. That they basically, like, he had a lot of duties there and basically was like, I don't want to do any of this stuff. All I want to do is draw the car and go to some races because it's fun. And they were like, great, that's all you have to do. And that's all he does. He just does the one thing. I don't think he manages anybody. I think he just draws the car and he shows up and sits on the pit wall.
No way is Aston getting that guy. Never mind. I think you make a very compelling point.
Yeah.
What if the same money, but considerably more work?
Right.
Yeah, no. And a lot of it not being draw the car type work. Yeah, that's a really good point. And this week we got a little taste of like how it can go bad if you don't put someone in the right spot and match their expectations correctly. McLaren just had their technical director, David Sanchez, leave the team after 3 months. And so remember they're much touted, like I think they broke the sort of the three-headed, the sort of Cerberus like model of how they were going to develop the car. One of those heads just fell off, and they're promoting internally. But reading between the lines of the statement they put out, it sounds to me like one of two things happened. Either this was a disastrous hire where Sanchez like basically fell on his face at McLaren and they had to pull the plug on it fast, or McLaren completely hired for the wrong position or scoped it poorly, and it was just an organizational dumpster fire as to how this played out. Because here's the statement they released. Following thoughtful discussions between David Sanchez and the team leadership, the mutual decision has been taken for David to leave the team, Andrea Stella said, according to the statement. It's credited to him. Upon a joint reflection, it became apparent that the role, responsibilities, and ambitions associated with David's position did not align with our original expectations when he agreed to join us in February 2023. Recognizing this misalignment, both David and I agreed that it would be best to part ways now so to enable him to pursue other opportunities that will better leverage the full scale and breadth of his remarkable skill set.
Boy, you think you'd align before you sign the deal. 3 months is not a long time.
No, and remember, they hired him in the winter of 2023. They had to wait out a non-compete or gardening leave period before he could start this gig, like this calendar year.
Right, because he joined from Ferrari.
Yeah. Poof, gone.
Man.
It's a year of investment in a technical director role. Just up in smoke. Obviously, it's better to like cauterize these sort of organizational wounds fast when you realize it's not working well. I think sometimes organizations keep things going way too long. But yeah, this notion that there being a misalignment, if that's true, then they're touted, the, you know, the here we're reorganizing and this is how we're going to compete better at McLaren, getting away from that horrible, evil matrix model of management and back to a good, you know, tripartite hierarchy of departments. That idea appears to have failed miserably. It's possible there's just not, you know, it can't be subdivided that neatly, and so he was a director without proper portfolio. But the other way this could have gone is, like, this is something you say when someone's just a terrible fit. Like, one of the things, one of the best but most awkward meetings I've ever been in my career was with someone who was just an incredibly difficult and problematic manager. It was sort of a come to Jesus meeting with some senior folks, and they sort of asked me and some other people who were having issues, like, you know, describe our role. And we did. And then the manager that people were having issues with was asked the same question, like, describe your role, like, what do you do on this project? And they ate shit. They didn't know what their job was, which was the core problem. They didn't know what their job was, which is why they're having friction with tons of people, because they didn't know what they were doing. They didn't understand the job. They didn't understand the company. And watching that sort of hit everyone, well, I mean, you know, those of us in the know knew it, but now it was like, now the bosses could see it. And it was awkward. It was very vindicating, but it was like brutal. And this is the sort of statement that you release when something like that happens, where it's like, oh, you're just not, you are not getting how you're supposed to operate in this team. And, you know, it's on us. We had different visions for the job going into it. So good luck. That's kind of how this reads, is that an implosion, basically. the alternative is, they invest all this stuff in this hire, and then they just never had a proper conversation about what the job would actually entail, which seems unlikely for the reasons we alluded to.
Yeah. What are you talking about? I take the designs from the designers and I give them to the engineers.
Yep. Yeah. not amazing. And obviously this is a, and, you know, a lot of ways, like, McLaren seemed like a team on an upswing. This seems like a setback for, you know.
It's a setback, but I could, like you said, I could read into it. I could read it as a positive, because they do seem, it, one could read it as them nipping something in the bud really quickly.
I think a lot of teams would try to hide the fact they screwed up a major, like, signature hire, because people like us will be like, ooh, things seem pretty unorganized and messed up at McLaren. And it might sometimes be the opposite, which is really swift diagnosis that this is not working out, immediate corrective action, let's move on, which is better than leaving a dysfunctional situation to fester. So either way, it's an interesting development. I'm curious where McLaren goes with this and what their organizational flowchart looks like in the near future. One other thing, just as technical regulations for 2026 are coming more into focus, I'm perhaps overly excited about this. They're bringing back the KERS button.
What?
This is part of the brief for the 2026 regs.
We got NOS?
We got NOS, baby. they are, like, it's all the hybrid stuff we're familiar with, more reliance on the battery power, yada, yada, yada. But part of the rules is going to be that there's got to be a button that the driver can mash burn some of that battery.
Rob, are they finally fixing the problem that I've had with the hybrids the whole time, where it's obscured from the audience? Like, if having an actual button is telling me that they're making it simpler for us to know when it's being deployed, right? Because you can see it in Formula E, you can see it in IndyCar, like,
yes.
It's a tactical thing, and they do it now, But it's so weird. It's like, you know, you can deploy it in this interesting way, but he's charging his battery right now, but we don't really know that. Like,
yeah,
I am excited for this. Maybe I shouldn't
100%
be
100% here for it. Like,
yeah.
And also, like, you just have to, the rule of cool. What's better? Like, oh, mode 7, please switch to, no, I don't give a shit about that. Imagine
flip of
the
button
anime.
That is you know, yellow and black striped.
Yep.
You have to open that first and then hit the red thing.
Yep.
Yes.
The speed lines start coming off the car, the driver. Yeah, no, exactly. This is what we need. The other thing is, I hope the rules leave latitude for drivers and engineers to feud over the radio about drivers going too hard on the ERS button, basically, because that's the other part of this that I want. Because given, you know, given the choice, you know, the pit wall is always going to be like, you're using too much battery right now. Can you dial back the pace? We need to. And I need there to be just more, a little more like Maverick and Top Gun type moments from this, where it's like, no, man, I got lock and tone. We're going now. I need that. F1 needs that.
Yes.
So I am ridiculously excited that this feature is coming. I think it's good news. And I do think it's one of the, if they present it well, I do think it'll borrow something that's really well presented, in particular in Formula E. Formula E makes such a good spectacle out of the state of battery and the sort of state of play for who can push, who's vulnerable. They're really good at communicating that. And yeah, F1 is this black box of, you know, sometimes you see the lights charging, you're like, okay, he's probably vulnerable, but I don't know if the last of his battery being topped up. You don't know. The fact that we could get to a point where it's like, he's got no more button left, he can't defend. Oh, mwah. Bring it on. Just two other things that quick hits. So Autosport had a huge breakdown of the Hamilton Ferrari deal. A lot of the stuff we already knew. It had some details that we hadn't heard, but one of the big ones is that the last contract, according to this article and the people they spoke with, the last contract Hamilton did with Mercedes, the one we saw discussed in the Netflix Drive to Survive this year, Hamilton wanted a longer-term deal. He was looking for that sort of, like, long-term commitment. This is going to be, like...
With,
you know,
Mercedes.
Maybe Yeah.
Okay.
And Mercedes did not want to do that because they were starting to think about life after Hamilton in particular. And I haven't watched enough Formula 2 to know anything about, like, how real is the hype around this guy, but Mercedes has on the line Andrea Kimi Antonelli, a prospect that people are talking about as like Verstappen level. The next Max is there in Formula 2. He's a Mercedes driver. And they did not want to ice him waiting for Hamilton to run out a from here to retirement contract. So they were only willing to do the 2-year contract given their interest in maybe like laying the groundwork for the next era. And according to this article, like that might have been one of the reasons that Hamilton was so receptive to a really sweet deal from Ferrari, because Ferrari were willing to make a longer term commitment. And it was clear that in addition now to saddling him with a piece of crap car, Mercedes was starting to think about, like, you know, it's been a good run, but time waits for no man.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. I don't know. Wasn't the deal with Max, though, that he'd never been that top a prospect in lower formula? Like, he was good, but he wasn't a dominant driver in those spaces the way like I think De Vries was, like Stoffel was. Like I feel like it's a bit like NFL quarterbacks. Like That college to pro jump is, you know, yes, it is like the final preparatory series, but the jump is real and different skills get prioritized. And I do wonder about the wisdom of being like, we got to get this Hamilton guy out of here because this kid, because this Wunderkind is over here. But I don't know, maybe at this point, Wolf was already wondering, like, did they leave George at Williams too long?
Yeah. I mean, it is tough to tell whether you're getting a, you know, well, Tom Brady was not a first famously. Round draft pick, right? He was famously like he was deep.
Seventh or, yeah.
But then you get like, I don't know, what's a good, like Tim Tebow, you know, just flames out.
Yeah. Doesn't work at all.
Tough to say. I also don't remember Max very well before that. And I feel like we had another one that like, was it Piastri who jumped up the formula like one per year? Like usually that's a pretty good.
Yeah.
Or is it Antonelli who jumped from like Formula 4 to Formula 2? I think that may have been. Yeah. I don't know. I don't have all the stats in front of me, but like, yeah, sometimes I don't know. It's easy to tell. Sometimes it's not.
I think there's a lot of, I think a lot of things broke right for Max. And I think there's a lot of, like, I'm not sure that's a reproducible model in terms of like, you know, I want the next Max Verstappen. Dude, so does everybody. That's not a plan. That is not a plan. You can't operationalize putting 17-year-olds in the car. That's not a guarantee that this is going to go that way that you think. The last story, just because we've showered so much praise on James Vowles and like the awesome stories he tells just routinely about how shitty Williams is. And we're like, we love your radical transparency, James. Bag on Williams some more. I love to hear about like other goofy stuff they were doing. Tell me more about like, you know, they were running. Tell me what like antique word processors they had installed on their computers. Like, tell us about the Win XP machine running the wind tunnel. Give it to me. So there was this interview with I think David Robson. Dave Robson. He is Williams' head of vehicle performance and has been for about a decade. So he goes back to the Claire Williams days. He's not a Williams lifer, but he's old regime.
If you right click on that Excel document, does it say created by D. Robson?
Exactly. So people ask him about like all these interviews that James Vowles is giving about like what he found when he got to Williams. And to me, this kind of seems like someone from old Williams felt they had to speak up and defend what they were doing. Maybe because some of the stuff is not sitting super well internally. He said, I think we've known for a long time that the way we do it or have done it isn't always terribly efficient, but it does rely on quite a lot of human glue to bring it all together. It'll be fascinating to know where the other teams are. I'm sure that the very best teams are quite different to how we do it. I don't know whether everyone is. To a certain extent, as you entertain the question, I think the big difference is Pat's and James's honesty about the whole thing, perhaps more than the actual problems themselves. That said, the problems are there, and they need fixing, and we were doing that. We've known it for a long time. But it's always very difficult to invest in those processes when you're struggling to invest in the car. That feels defensive. like that some of this is like kind of wounded. The old Williams folks, because we've laughed about this in part because like, look at these dumbasses. They've got look at their stupid spreadsheet. And I think the thing that does get lost is like people in these situations, they always know this stuff is messed up. You know, there's no way you're interacting with that system. You don't know this is not right and that it couldn't be better. The reason it doesn't get fixed is because nobody can. and you are busy just trying to hold it all together.
Yeah, I am not here telling you that I don't think there isn't a zip drive somewhere in the Sauber headquarters, right? With some
little caddy, some
key documents. Yes.
Yep.
Yeah, I think it's probably two things. It's probably like we're only understanding this is how some Formula One teams work because of this transparency, yep. And also Williams has had a rough go recently, yeah. Right? But it has, unlike a lot of these other teams, like you, there are these charts, right? Of like, here's what all these, this Formula One team used to be this team, and it used to be this team, and it used to be that team. Williams has been Williams the whole time. There have been no opportunities for them to make these resets until now. And so they might be one of the teams with the most baggage. But yeah, I think this is a totally human response, and I hope that I hope that when James says these things that he knows that he's got the, or like his team knows that he's doing it from not a place of just dunking on them, you know, that, cause that wouldn't be helpful. Right.
No, it has to be the case. And I do hope they all know the score. And they probably do. I think the things that Valls has to do is he has to sell this idea of a team turnaround, even yeah. if like,
even you know, to the team. Ways,
yeah. It has to become part of the narrative. And so it behooves him to talk about like, all the things that were broken and dusty at Williams, that he's the breath of fresh air he's cleaning out. And yeah, it valorizes him, makes him look good, makes the team look bad. But it is a story that is useful for the head of a, that is useful for Williams to have like the head of the team going out and telling. And I do feel like some of this though is some pushback from some of the veterans being like, okay, but it's not like you're the first smart person to show up at Williams and like yeah. see it shouldn't be like this.
Yeah.
And you know, someone, you know, the highest ranking person from the old guard, they do have to be the one to get in front of reporters and be like, hey, like we were on it. We just didn't have the resources, but like, we're not dummies. And don't paint us that way.
Well, from the news, we look forward to Japan, Rob, and the Suzuka International Racing Course, which is located in Ino, Suzuka City, Mie Prefecture. It began life as a Honda test track in 1962 and first held an F1 event in 1987. And from there, we've only spent 4 years away from it. In 2007 and 2008, when the Japanese Grand Prix was held at Fuji Speedway, and in 2020 and 21, due to COVID. In the early years, Suzuka was often where the championship was decided, sometimes controversially, like when Senna and Prost came together. I saw F1 posted a YouTube video recently that said it was 13 times the championship was decided in Japan. Unfortunately, it is now in the first half of the season these days. But it has hosted many other racing series, including MotoGP, and even held a NASCAR exhibition race or two in 96 and 97, both of which you can find on YouTube. I'll put those in the show notes. It's 3.6 miles long or 5.8 kilometers and is the only FIA Grade 1 track to have a figure eight layout. Although apparently the original designs had it crossing over itself three times instead of just one. Like a lot of circuits, it has undergone a number of changes over the years for safety reasons, but currently it houses 18 turns. So Sector 1 begins with the start-finish straight, which is the only DRS zone. And at the end of that is a high-speed but relatively gentle right-hander of Turn 1 that tightens into Turn 2, and then dumps you into these five quick back-and-forth S-curves, which understand is a driver favorite. As you enter Sector 2, you pass underneath the bridge, which is where the track overlaps itself. And then Turn 11 is a hairpin, followed by a right-hand curve that leads into the spoon section of Turn 13 and 14, which is apparently pretty tricky to get right. It's kind of a double apex sort of deal. And then you get onto the back straight where the cars gain speed before hitting sector 3 and turn 15, also known as 130R, which I always think sounds like, you know, the name of a mech, you know, a Gundam.
It's one of the wildest. It's an amazing corner. It doesn't look like anything on the circuit layout, but like the map can't do justice to the speed you carry into that turn and the way that like an F1 car in particular, you can just flick through there. And it looks for all the world. It looks for all the world like everyone should be dead at that corner. Like, it's just one of the most ridiculous, like, you cannot, like, cars moving that speed, making that corner is just incredible.
Yeah, I imagine seeing it in person, it would look strange because you can't see the downforce happening, right? Like, that car should be flying off of that track, not making this turn. But it's flat out, apparently, these days in these cars. Fastest part of the track. Then it's into the casino chicane at 16 and 17. And finally, another gentle right.
Casino or Casio?
I'm sorry. Casio. Japan. And
yep, you got Monaco. It looms so large.
It really does. Another historical track. And then that right-hander back onto the start-finish straight. We'll be doing 53 laps for a total of 191 miles or 307 kilometers. Hamilton holds the lap record here of a 1 minute 30.983. It is a high-speed, flowing track, fan and driver favorite with a lot of overtaking spots. Last year, we had a bunch of people crunched into each other, so anything can happen here, especially if it rains. So keep your eyes peeled. Also for elaborate cosplay from the fans, the functional DRS hat is a classic. And
I know
also,
it's easy to just get carried away on like the weird Japan type stuff, but I don't think that's what we're doing here. I don't think what the cameras are picking up. Like, Japanese fans just like, they're really good fans, and they're super creative, like what they bring to the track. It's always a really, really cool crowd.
Yeah, people talk about, you know, people that are there, like the commentators and the drivers and stuff, talk about the atmosphere and how, you know, excited everybody is and supportive and positive. And it honestly comes through in the television broadcast somehow. And it lends just another layer to it that's really fun.
It's one of those places where a lot of times you see big crowds, like, toughing out truly horrific weather.
Yeah. I'll also mention, when researching the track, I came upon a Japanese Grand Prix track preview video on the official Williams YouTube channel, featuring one Pastor Maldonado, a video from 2012. It has only 300 views. It is a static shot, I think, in a hotel room. With the onboard camera mic, we've really come a long way on YouTube and Formula One content marketing. I'll link that in the show notes as well. It's like 67 seconds long or something. But yeah, speaking of weather, the afternoon of April 6th, local time, we are looking at 66 degrees Fahrenheit or 19 Celsius. Low wind, chance of precipitation this qualifying day, 25%. Race day, however, same temperature, higher wind. We've got wind of 10 miles an hour or 16 kilometers an hour out of the east, with gusts up to 30 miles an hour or 48 kilometers an hour. Cloud cover and a chance of precipitation 90%.
Hell yeah. Bring on the sprinklers.
Yeah. We shall see. And heading into the Japanese Grand Prix, the driver standings look like this. Max Verstappen is on top with 51 points, only 4 points behind is Charles Leclerc in second. Sergio Perez is 1 point behind him with 46. Carlos Sainz is in fourth with 40. Oscar Piastri is in fifth with 28. Then we've got Lando Norris with 27. George Russell with 18. Fernando Alonso with 16. Lance Stroll with 9. And in 10th place, Lewis Hamilton with 8 points. Behind him, Yuki Tsunoda and Oliver Bearman, both with 6 points. Nico Hülkenberg in 13th with 3, and Kevin Magnussen in 14th with 1. The rest of them, Albon, Zhou, Ricciardo, Ocon, Gasly, Bottas, and Sargeant, all have 0. In the constructor standings, Red Bull Racing is on top with 97 points. 4 points behind is Ferrari in 2nd place. Then we've got McLaren in 3rd with 55. Mercedes in 4th with 26. Aston Martin in 5th with 25. Sixth place is RB with 6 points. Gene Haas and team are in 7th with 4. And then the zeros of Williams, Sauber, and Alpine. If you'd like to join the standings yourself, you could do so using the link in the show notes to our fantasy league. And you can also send us an email, shiftf1podcast@gmail.com or f1.cool/emails. Rob, what have you pulled for us this week?
Well, Adrian wrote in with a question and some concerns. Hello to my favorite F1 podcast and podcasters. It seems everything is more exciting than racing in F1 this year. F1 Academy being easier to watch. A race car driver that was not signed to race in the season is at the time of this letter's writing, 7th in the Drivers' Championship. Carlos's fortunes have improved since then. Christian Horner rumors. 2024 silly season starting before the 2024 season started. New companies coming in F1, but still sticking with the bleached mullet despite it clearly not working. I have not been able to get excited enough to watch the latest Drive to Survive season, create F1 fantasy teams, or update my epic F1 spreadsheet, which is what I used last year, to give you stats on shady blockchain sponsors and other fun insights. I remember that email.
Oh, yes.
The question, how do F1 fans make it through 2024, as it's looking like the longest season ever could be the most boring ever? Regards, Adrian. So, I'm getting a little more, like, got that taste of someone besides Max winning, and like, I'm like, what if Carlos has a little run here? What if Ferrari's back? Probably not, but I'm in a moment of like, I'm letting myself dream a little bit. I do think, though, it is undeniable that we talked about this, like the racing is a little less interesting. You know, I think if you take away, and we talked about this after the show last week, if you take away like the DNFs and the reshuffling of like Ferrari to the front of that field, after all that chaos, things were a little less compelling toward the front of the race again. You know, it's not been the most action-packed season. So as for getting through phases like this, and they come and go in F1, you know, obviously if it's part of a balanced racing diet, there's good racing happening somewhere. You know, may I introduce you to the Mazda MX-5 Cup if you just want like nonstop action. But I think the other thing is, and this is the damnable thing about F1 and why I can't like just quit it. In moments like this, last season was really frustrating and it was kind of boring for similar reasons. But then you get a race like the Dutch Grand Prix, which was not something I circled. I don't think that's a great F1 track, but like, you just never know when all hell's going to break loose and you see an absolute like all-timer race. And what sort of keeps me around is, like, I want to be there when that amazing racing happens, when you have the fireworks, when it all comes together and you come out of an F1 race, like, holy hell, did you all just see that? That's amazing, and that's kind of what keeps me coming back, even when the sport is not at its most compelling. I think 2021... distorted all of our brains. It altered our brain chemistry for like what we got a taste of what like an F1 season unfolding like a movie script could be like. And we immediately forgot that in general, this is a sport that has a dominant team for like each era.
Yeah, I think that's really well said. And I would say that you're right. We're a little thrown out of whack, but it's only because of the valleys that you get the peaks. And which is not to say that, like, yeah, if you're finding it a waste of time, don't feel like you have to watch it. But like, that's why I watch it. Or one of the reasons, you know, is to give myself the fuller picture so that when something is remarkable, then I'll really be able to appreciate it.
Yeah. But hey, check out that Drive to Survive season. It was really good.
It was good.
Even if you're not saying it's the cure to what ails you, but it's a good series. Drew, you want to read this next one?
Sure. Merlin from Brunswick, Germany writes in, "Dear Shift F1 crew, this week I was binging the latest season of Drive to Survive when the following question came up for me. Can you distinguish the team staff titles / roles of CEO, executive director, and team principal? As a native German speaker, they all seem quite important to me, but I couldn't tell the difference. Thanks for trying to clear it up. Am a big fan since Drew's GB days. Keep up the great work." Thank you, Merlin. Amazing name, by the way.
Does it feel like job titles in Germany might be a little more prescriptive than they are elsewhere? Because that's my first reaction, is like, I feel like team principal is not a job title necessarily. It is just a thing we identify as, like, this is the person who speaks for this team. But, and like leads this team, but doesn't necessarily mean that person is not also effectively like the CEO of a team.
Yeah. I mean, team print, like, it's, that's a made up for F1 job title for sure. I don't know. I haven't heard that anywhere else, maybe in other motorsports, but yeah. So I would say, first of all, that, it's not every team has the same structure, right? So sometimes most of the time you get a team principal. Sometimes there's, like, you know, three guys. Like, Alpine's a weird one, right? Aren't there like three people that kind of do that job?
Yeah.
I think Eyo Komatsu at Haas has said that, like, you know, Günther Steiner was both the team principal and effectively the CEO of the team, because he would go out and get funding. And Komatsu just wants to run the actual racing part of it, you know, the production of the car, the strategy of the race, you know, he wants to manage all that stuff. Someone else can go get sponsorship dollars. So with that caveat, I would, to sort of, my take on these things when I hear them is that team principal has at least the job of building the car, or at least overseeing the job of building the car and the race day strategy. When I hear CEO as distinct from the team principal, that to me means the money guy, like making the business work. So you look at a team like McLaren, Zach Brown is the guy you think of as the head of McLaren. He's not the team principal, though. That's Andrea Stella. So Zach Brown isn't doing any of the, you know, he doesn't have a, I imagine, doesn't have a say in the car design, doesn't have a say as to the strategy on race day. That's Andrea Stella. Zach Brown brings in the money and makes sure the lights stay on. So sometimes I think Christian Horner is both of those. And so in like more expanded lower thirds titles, sometimes you'll see CEO, or owner / team principal. I think Toto Wolff is another example, where they're kind of all wrapped up in one person. Executive director, that's sort of vague. I don't really know what to make of that. But I imagine you could probably subdivide even further between, like, you know, car design, race day strategy, and money guy. What do you think, Rob?
Yeah, I think that's the that's a good way of breaking it down. Like, team principal is day-to-day operations, whatever that means. Whoever, like, owns most of those, that's what that role is, regardless of, like, what specific title a person carries around a team. And then, yeah, some of them do like to mix and match, where it's, like, more of an executive CEO-type team principal. Sometimes the executive director stuff is distinct from, like, technical directors. I think sometimes also you see these things where it's actually more reflective of interference from above, is the way I put it. Like, maybe there's too much corporate structure happening around an F1 team. I'm thinking about, like, when Amar Safnauer suddenly had someone he was reporting to at Alpine. He was still team principal of Alpine, but suddenly there was, like, a new position overseeing the team between him and, you know, corporate. And sometimes when something like that snaps into existence, that's a sign that there's a bit of, you know, lack of clarity over who should be running what, and they're trying to reassign roles and responsibilities without necessarily, like, changing titles or shifting personnel. But yeah, like, in general, these other hats can be worn by people who are the team principal, or they can be passed off to other folks. The McLaren example's great, because Zach Brown is the face of McLaren and does not run that team day to day.
Yeah. Thank you for the emails. ShiftF1Podcast@gmail.com or F1.cool/emails if you'd like to send us a note. You could also hit us up on the socials. Rob, I did an experiment today.
Yeah.
I posted to Facebook and Mastodon, okay, which are usually what we post to. I also posted to Blue Sky and Instagram and Facebook.
Okay.
Blue Sky. So I'm not sure. I'm experimenting with a scheduling service, because Mastodon and Twitter have free versions of that.
Yeah.
There's a posting service called Buffer that does Instagram and Facebook. Blue Sky doesn't have one yet, so postings there may be spotty, since I can't schedule them. But yeah, if you're so inclined, though, that's where we are right now.
4 likes on one post. Come on, folks, you got to get to Blue Sky or don't. But up to you where you want to move your online.
That was the first post. Yes. I will note. So don't have quite a following there yet. But just wanted to be out there where the people are. So yeah, you can hit us up around the socials or indeed anywhere on the internet. And you can also race around the world. We've got the Craftsman Trucks this weekend. They're in Martinsville Speedway for the Long John Silver's 200. Them trucks are getting battered and fried.
Sorry, do they have Long John Silver's out where you are?
I haven't seen one in person in a while.
I've only seen it in the Midwest. I guess I imagine Long John Silver would have a hard time penetrating the Northeast, given that, like, seafood shacks are endemic around here. But yeah, no, it was always like, sorry, no shade to Long John Silver, but, like, whenever my dad was like, hey, we're having Long John Silver tonight, I was like, oh, shit. Damn it.
Well, it is in Martinsville, Virginia, at the Martinsville Speedway. Trucks are on Friday. The NASCAR Xfinity Series is on Saturday for the, I'm not making this up, Dude Wipes.
Nope.
250.
I swear to God, if it's flushable wipes, I'm gonna lose my mind.
Let's look this up here. DUDE is in all caps.
God damn it! God damn it! Oh.
Billions, hey, bro, of butts wiped.
Does your hiney ever get tender, but you don't want to deal with that like a woman? God, I hope these come in, like, some sort of matte tactical canister. By the way, again, always need to put this out there. Flushable wipes are not flushable. Just like that's a myth that the big flushable wipe wants to sell you. But dude. Like, it's one of the major reasons that like municipal sewer departments like routinely have like clogged sewers, because that stuff just like goes down and doesn't go anywhere. So just a fun fact to just bear in mind. There's people who like, if this were a thing, you know, it wouldn't have taken this much marketing to make happen.
We don't have camo, but we do have matte black.
That is matte black. Yeah.
Yeah. You can get fragrance free or mint chill as seen on Shark Tank. Okay. The Motocross Grand Prix of Sardinia is in Italy at the Cosodromo Comunale Le Dune. The spice must flow.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
The NHRA Arizona Nationals are taking place at Firebird Motorsports Park in Chandler, Arizona.
We got NASCAR. Don't think Martinsville is going to let you go, because we got the Cookout 400. We're cooking Long John Silvers, and then we're
dude wiping.
We're dude wiping.
Formula One also this weekend. Maybe you've heard of it. We're in Oceania again, so the times are weird. I'm going to say the Eastern times here. Thursday, April 4th at 10:30 p.m. is when Free Practice 1 is on ESPNU. And then a few hours later at 2 a.m. on Friday, April 5th, we've got Free Practice 2 on ESPN2. And then later that night, 10:30 p.m. is Free Practice 3 on ESPN News. Followed by a few hours later, Saturday, April 6th at 2 a.m. is qualifying on ESPN2. And Sunday, everyone, April 7th at 1 a.m. Eastern, the race on ESPN. I've already queued the race times post. So get ready for that.
On all our socials.
Yeah, we'll see how it goes. I did see that Buffer was having trouble with the Meta network, so be gentle. And yeah, now we're at the end of this podcast, Rob. Final thoughts ahead of Japan.
I think like it does feel for me like there's a bit of a test here, because there was all this hype around, hey, Ferrari's got some real pace. That Red Bull is mortal this season in a way it has not been. I need to see that bear out in a race that Max actually runs to the end. You know, mm-hmm. I need to see that thing beaten in the straight fight without a big giant locked break asterisk around the entire thing. But like, if he doesn't run away with this thing, that would really change the tenor of the season.
Sure would. I guess we'll have to see. If you would like to support the show and get access to all of our bonus episodes, the ad-free version of the podcast, and the official Shift F1 Discord, you can do so over at patreon.com/shiftf1. Have a good race weekend, everyone. We will see you all next week.